Geraldine's heart. There was the time, for example, when a bunch of us were desperate to go out and practice rounders during break, because we'd been challenged by a group from the year above. Our problem was that it was raining, and it looked unlikely we'd be allowed outside. I noticed, though, that Miss Geraldine was one of the guardians on duty, and so I said, "If Ruth goes and asks Miss Geraldine, then we'd stand a chance." As far as I remember, this suggestion wasn't taken up. Maybe hardly anyone heard it, because a lot of us were talking all at once. But the point is, I said it standing right behind Ruth, and I could see she was pleased. Then another time a few of us were leaving a classroom with Miss Geraldine, and I happened to find myself about to go out the door right after Miss Geraldine herself. What I did was to slow right down, so that Ruth, coming behind me, could instead pass through the door beside Miss Geraldine. I did this without any fuss, as though this were the natural and proper thing, and what Miss Geraldine would like. Just the way I'd have done if, say, I'd accidentally got myself between two best friends. On that occasion, as far as I remember, Ruth looked puzzled and surprised for a split second, then gave me a quick nod and went past. Little things like these might well have pleased Ruth, but they were still far removed from what had actually happened between us under the eaves that foggy day, and the sense that I'd never be able to sort things just continued to grow. There's a particular memory I have of sitting by myself one evening on one of the benches outside the pavilion, trying over and over to think of some way out, while a heavy mix of remorse and frustration brought me virtually to tears. If things had stayed that way, I'm not sure what would have happened. Maybe it would all have got forgotten eventually. Or maybe Ruth and I would have drifted apart. As it was, right out of the blue, a chance came along for me to put things right. We were in the middle of one of Mr. Rogers' art lessons, except for some reason he'd gone out halfway, so we were all just drifting about among the easels, chatting and looking at each other's work. Then at one point a girl called Midge A came over to where we were and said to Ruth, in a perfectly friendly way, "Where's your pencil case? It's so luscious." Ruth tensed and glanced quickly about to see who was present. It was our usual gang, with perhaps a couple of outsiders loitering nearby. I hadn't mentioned to a soul anything about the sales register business, but I suppose Ruth wasn't to know that. Her voice was softer than usual when she replied to Midge. "I haven't got it here. I keep it in my collection chest." "It's so luscious. Where did you get it?" Midge was quizzing her completely innocently. That was now obvious. But almost all of us who'd been in room 5 the time Ruth had first brought out the pencil case were here now, looking on, and I saw Ruth hesitate. It was only later, when I replayed it all, that I appreciated how perfectly shaped a chance it was for me. At the time, I didn't really think. I just came in before Midge or anyone else had the chance to notice Ruth was in a curious quandary. "We can't say where it came from." Ruth, Midge, the rest of them, they all looked at me, maybe a little surprised. But I kept my cool and went on, addressing only Midge. "There are some very good reasons why we can't tell you where it came from." Midge shrugged.
"So it's a mystery."
"A big mystery," I said, then gave her a smile to show her I wasn't trying to be nasty to her. The others were nodding to back me up, though Ruth herself had on a vague expression, like she'd suddenly become preoccupied with something else entirely. Midge shrugged again, and as far as I remember, that was the end of it. Either she walked off or else she started talking about something different. Now, for much the same reasons I'd not been able to talk openly to Ruth about what I'd done to her over the sales register business, she, of course, wasn't able to thank me for the way I'd intervened with Midge. But it was obvious from her manner towards me, not just over the next few days, but over the weeks that followed, how pleased she was with me. And having recently been in much the same position, it was easy to recognize the signs of her looking around for some opportunity to do something nice, something really special for me. It was a good feeling, and I remember even thinking once or twice how it would be better if she didn't get a chance for ages, just so the good feeling between us could go on and on. As it was, an opportunity did come along for her, about a month after the Midge episode, the time I lost my favourite tape. I still have a copy of that tape, and until recently, I'd listened to it occasionally, driving out in the open country on a drizzly day. But now the tape machine in my car's got so dodgy I don't dare play it in that, and there never seems enough time to play it when I'm back in my bedsit. Even so, it's one of my most precious possessions. Maybe, come the end of the year, when I'm no longer a carer, I'll be able to listen to it more often. The album's called Songs After Dark, and it's by Judy Bridgewater. What I've got today isn't the actual cassette, the one I had back then at Hailsham, the one I lost. It's the one Tommy and I found in Norfolk years afterwards, but that's another story I'll come to later. What I want to talk about is the first tape, the one that disappeared. I should explain before I go any further this whole thing we had in those days about Norfolk. We kept it going for years and years. It became a sort of in-joke, I suppose. And it all started from one particular lesson we had when we were pretty young. It was Miss Emily herself who taught us about the different counties of England. She'd pin up a big map over the blackboard, and next to it set up an easel. And if she was talking about, say, Oxfordshire, she'd place on the easel a large calendar with photos of the county. She had quite a collection of these picture calendars, and we got through most of the counties this way. She'd tap a spot on the map with her pointer, turn to the easel, and reveal another picture. There'd be little villages with streams going through them, white monuments on hillsides, old churches beside fields. If she was telling us about a coastal place, there'd be beaches crowded with people, cliffs with seagulls. I suppose she wanted us to have a grasp of what was out there surrounding us, and it's amazing, even now, after all these miles I've covered as a carer, the extent to which my idea of the various counties is still set by these pictures Miss Emily put up on her easel. I'd be driving through Derbyshire, say, and catch myself looking for a particular village green with a mock Tudor pub and a war memorial, and realize it's the image Miss Emily showed us the first time I ever heard of Derbyshire. Anyway, the point is, there was a gap in Miss Emily's calendar collection. None of them had a single picture of Norfolk. We had these same lectures repeated a number of times, and I'd always wonder if this time she'd found a picture of Norfolk, but it was always the same. She'd wave her pointer over the map and say, as a sort of afterthought, "And over here we've got Norfolk. Very nice there." Then, that particular time, I remember how she paused and drifted off into thought, maybe because she hadn't planned what should happen next instead of a picture. Eventually she came out of her dream and tapped the map again. "You see, because it's stuck out here on the east, on this hump jutting into the sea, it's not on the way to anywhere. People going north and south," she moved the pointer up and down, "they bypass it altogether. For that reason it's a peaceful corner of England, rather nice, but it's also something of a lost corner." A lost corner. That's what she called it. And that was what started it. Because at Hailsham, we had our own lost corner up on the third floor, where the lost property was kept. If you lost or found anything, that's where you went. Someone, I can't remember who it was, claimed after the lesson that what Miss Emily had said was that Norfolk was England's lost corner, where all the lost property found in the country ended up. Somehow, this idea caught on, and soon had become accepted fact virtually throughout our entire year. Not long ago, when Tommy and I were reminiscing about all of this, he thought we'd never really believed in the notion that it was a joke right from the start. But I'm pretty certain he was wrong there. Sure enough, by the time we were 12 or 13, the Norfolk thing had become a big joke. But my memory of it, and Ruth remembered it the same way, is that at the beginning, we believed in Norfolk in the most literal way, that just as lorries came to Hailsham with our food and stuff for our sales, there was some similar operation going on, except on a grander scale, with vehicles moving all over England, delivering anything left behind in fields and trains, to this place called Norfolk. The fact that we'd never seen a picture of the place only added to its mystique. This might all sound daft, but you have to remember that to us, at that stage in our lives, any place beyond Hailsham was like a fantasy land. We had only the haziest notions of the world outside, and about what was and wasn't possible there. Besides, we never bothered to examine our Norfolk theory in any detail. What was important to us, as Ruth said one evening when we were sitting in that tiled room in Dover, looking out at the sunset, was that when we lost something precious, and we'd looked and looked and still couldn't find it, then we didn't have to be completely heartbroken. We still had that last bit of comfort, thinking one day when we were grown up and we were free to travel around the country, we could always go and find it again in Norfolk. I'm sure Ruth was right about that. Norfolk came to be a real source of comfort for us, probably much more than we admitted at the time, and that was why we were still talking about it, albeit as a sort of joke, when we were much older. And that's why, years and years later, that day Tommy and I found another copy of that lost tape of mine in a town on the Norfolk coast, we didn't just think it pretty funny. We both felt deep down some tug, some old wish to believe again in something that was once close to our hearts. But I wanted to talk about my tape, Songs After Dark by Judy Bridgewater. I suppose it was originally an LP, the recording date's 1956, but what I had was the cassette, and the cover picture was what must have been a scaled-down version of the record sleeve. Judy Bridgewater is wearing a purple satin dress, one of those off-the-shoulder ones popular in those days, and you can see her from just above the waist because she's sitting on a bar stool. I think it's supposed to be South America, because there are palms behind her and swarthy waiters in white tuxedos. You're looking at Judy from exactly where the barman would be when he's serving her drinks. She's looking back in a friendly, not too sexy way, like she might be flirting just a tiny bit, but you're someone she knows from way back. Now, the other thing about this cover is that Judy's got her elbows up on the bar, and there's a cigarette burning in her hand. And it was because of this cigarette that I got so secretive about the tape, right from the moment I found it at the sale. I don't know how it was where you were, but at Hailsham the guardians were really strict about smoking. I'm sure they'd have preferred it if we never found out smoking even existed, but since this wasn't possible, they made sure to give us some sort of lecture each time any reference to cigarettes came along. Even if we were being shown a picture of a famous writer or world leader, and they happened to have a cigarette in their hand, then the whole lesson would grind to a halt. There was even a rumour that some classic books, like the Sherlock Holmes ones, weren't in our library because the main characters smoked too much, and when you came across a page torn out of an illustrated book or magazine, this was because there'd been a picture on it of someone smoking. And then there were the actual lessons where they showed us horrible pictures of what smoking did to the insides of your body. That's why it was such a shock that time Marge Kay asked Miss Lucy her question. We were sitting on the grass after a rounders match, and Miss Lucy had been giving us a typical talk on smoking, when Marge suddenly asked if Miss Lucy had herself ever had a cigarette. Miss Lucy went quiet for a few seconds. Then she said, "I'd like to be able to say no. But to be honest, I did smoke for a little while. For about 2 years when I was younger." You can imagine what a shock this was. Before Miss Lucy's reply, we'd all been glaring at Marge, really furious she'd asked such a rude question. To us, she might as well have asked if Miss Lucy had ever attacked anyone with an axe. And for days afterwards, I remember how we made Marge's life an utter misery. In fact, that incident I mentioned before, the night we held Marge's face to the dorm window to make her look at the woods, that was all part of what came afterwards. But at the time, the moment Miss Lucy said what she did, we were too confused to think any more about Marge. I think we all just stared at Miss Lucy in horror, waiting for what she'd say next. When she did speak, Miss Lucy seemed to be weighing up each word carefully. It's not good that I smoked. It wasn't good for me, so I stopped it. But what you must understand is that for you, all of you, it's much, much worse to smoke than it ever was for me. Then she paused and went quiet. Someone said later she'd gone off into a daydream, but I was pretty sure, as was Ruth, that she was thinking hard about what to say next. Finally, she said, "You've been told about it. Your students. Your special. So keeping yourselves well, keeping yourselves very healthy inside, that's much more important for each of you than it is for me." She stopped again and looked at us in a strange way. Afterwards, when we discussed it, some of us were sure she was dying for someone to ask, "Why? Why is it so much worse for us?" But no one did. I've often thought about that day, and I'm sure now, in the light of what happened later, that we only needed to ask, and Miss Lucy would have told us all kinds of things. All it would have taken was just one more question about smoking. So why had we stayed silent that day? I suppose it was because even at that age, we were 9 or 10, we knew just enough to make us wary of that whole territory. It's hard now to remember just how much we knew by then. We certainly knew, though not in any deep sense, that we were different from our guardians, and also from the normal people outside. We perhaps even knew that a long way down the line there were donations waiting for us. But we didn't really know what that meant. If we were keen to avoid certain topics, it was probably more because it embarrassed us. We hated the way our guardians, usually so on top of everything, became so awkward whenever we came near this territory. It unnerved us to see them change like that. I think that's why we never asked that one further question, and why we punished Marge Kay so cruelly for bringing it all up that day after the Rounders match. Anyway, that's why I was so secretive about my tape. I even turned the cover inside out so you'd only see Judy and her cigarette if you opened up the plastic case. But the reason the tape meant so much to me had nothing to do with a cigarette, or even with the way Judy Bridgewater sang. She's one of those singers from her time, cocktail bar stuff, not the sort of thing any of us at Hailsham liked. What made the tape so special for me was this one particular song, track number 3, Never Let Me Go. It's slow and late night and American, and there's a bit that keeps coming round when Judy sings, "Never let me go, oh baby, baby, never let me go." I was 11 then, and hadn't listened to much music, but this one song, it really got to me. I always tried to keep the tape wound to just that spot so I could play the song whenever a chance came by. I didn't have so many opportunities, mind you, this being a few years before Walkmans started appearing at the sales. There was a big machine in the billiards room, but I hardly ever played the tape in there because it was always full of people. The art room also had a player, but that was usually just as noisy. The only place I could listen properly was in our dorm. By then we'd gone into the small 6-bed dorms over in the separate huts, and in ours we had a portable cassette player up on the shelf above the radiator. So that's where I used to go, in the day when no one else was likely to be about, to play my song over and over. What was so special about this song? Well, the thing was, I didn't used to listen properly to the words. I just waited for that bit that went, "Baby, baby, never let me go." And what I'd imagine was a woman who'd been told she couldn't have babies, who'd really, really wanted them all her life. Then there's a sort of miracle, and she has a baby, and she holds this baby very close to her, and walks around singing, "Baby, never let me go," partly because she's so happy, but also because she's so afraid something will happen, that the baby will get ill or be taken away from her. Even at the time, I realized this couldn't be right, that this interpretation didn't fit with the rest of the lyrics. But that wasn't an issue with me. The song was about what I said, and I used to listen to it again and again, on my own whenever I got the chance. There was one strange incident around this time I should tell you about here. It really unsettled me, and although I wasn't to find out its real meaning until years later, I think I sensed even then some deeper significance to it. It was a sunny afternoon, and I'd gone to our dorm to get something. I remember how bright it was because the curtains in our room hadn't been pulled back properly, and you could see the sun coming in big shafts and see all the dust in the air. I hadn't meant to play the tape, but since I was there all by myself, an impulse made me get the cassette out of my collection box and put it into the player. Maybe the volume had been turned right up by whoever had been using it last, I don't know, but it was much louder than I usually had it, and that was probably why I didn't hear her before I did. Or maybe I'd just got complacent by then. Anyway, what I was doing was swaying about slowly in time to the song, holding an imaginary baby to my breast. In fact, to make it all the more embarrassing, it was one of those times I'd grabbed a pillow to stand in for the baby, and I was doing this slow dance, my eyes closed, singing along softly each time those lines came around again. Oh, baby, baby, never let me go. The song was almost over when something made me realize I wasn't alone, and I opened my eyes to find myself staring at Madame framed in the doorway. I froze in shock. Then, within a second or two, I began to feel a new kind of alarm, because I could see there was something strange about the situation. The door was almost half open. It was a sort of rule we couldn't close dorm doors completely, except for when we were sleeping. But Madame hadn't nearly come up to the threshold. She was out in the corridor, standing very still, her head angled to one side to give her a view of what I was doing inside. And the odd thing was, she was crying. It might even have been one of her sobs that had come through the song to jerk me out of my dream. When I think about this now, it seems to me, even if she wasn't a guardian, she was the adult, and she should have said or done something, even if it was just to tell me off. Then I'd have known how to behave. But she just went on standing out there, sobbing and sobbing, staring at me through the doorway with that same look in her eyes she always had when she looked at us, like she was seeing something that gave her the creeps. Except this time there was something else. Something extra in that look I couldn't fathom. I didn't know what to do or say, or what to expect next. Perhaps she would come into the room, shout at me, hit me even. I didn't have a clue. As it was, she turned, and the next moment I could hear her footsteps leaving the hut. I realized the tape had gone on to the next track, and I turned it off and sat down on the nearest bed. And as I did so, I saw through the window in front of me her figure hurrying off towards the main house. She didn't glance back, but I could tell from the way her back was hunched up she was still sobbing. When I got back to my friends a few minutes later, I didn't tell them anything about what had happened. Someone noticed I wasn't right and said something, but I just shrugged and kept quiet. I wasn't ashamed exactly, but it was a bit like that earlier time when we'd all waylaid Madame in the courtyard as she got out of her car. What I wished more than anything was that the thing hadn't happened at all, and I thought that by not mentioning it, I'd be doing myself and everyone else a favour. I did, though, talk to Tommy about it a couple of years later. This was in those days following our conversation by the pond, when he'd first confided in me about Miss Lucy, the days during which, as I see it, we started off our whole thing of wondering and asking questions about ourselves that we kept going between us through the years. When I told Tommy about what had happened with Madame in the dorm, he came up with a fairly simple explanation. By then, of course, we all knew something I hadn't known back then, which was that none of us could have babies. It's just possible I'd somehow picked up the idea when I was younger without fully registering it, and that's why I heard what I did when I listened to that song. But there was no way I'd known properly back then. As I say, by the time Tommy and I were discussing it, we'd all been told clearly enough. None of us, incidentally, was particularly bothered about it. In fact, I remember some people being pleased we could have sex without worrying about all of that, though proper sex was still some way off for most of us at that stage. Anyway, when I told Tommy about what had happened, he said, "Madame's probably not a bad person, even though she's creepy. So when she saw you dancing like that, holding your baby, she thought it was really tragic, how you couldn't have babies. That's why she started crying."
"But Tommy," I pointed out, "how could she have known the song had anything to do with people having babies? How could she have known the pillow I was holding was supposed to be a baby? That was only in my head."
Tommy thought about this, then said, only half jokingly, "Maybe Madame can read minds. She's strange. Maybe she can see right inside you. It wouldn't surprise me."
This gave us both a little chill, and though we giggled, we didn't say any more about it.
The tape disappeared a couple of months after the incident with Madame. I never linked the two events at the time, and I've no reason to link them now. I was in the dorm one night, just before lights out, and was rummaging through my collection chest to pass the time until the others came back from the bathroom. It's odd, but when it first dawned on me the tape wasn't there anymore, my main thought was that I mustn't give away how panicked I was. I can remember actually making a point of humming absent-mindedly while I went on searching. I've thought about it a lot, and I still don't know how to explain it. These were my closest friends in that room with me, and yet I didn't want them to know how upset I was about my tape going missing. I suppose it had something to do with it being a secret, just how much it had meant to me. Maybe all of us at Hailsham had little secrets like that. Little private nooks created out of thin air, where we could go off alone with our fears and longings. But the very fact that we had such needs would have felt wrong to us at that time, like somehow we were letting the side down. Anyway, once I was quite sure the tape was gone, I asked each of the others in the dorm very casually if they'd seen it. I wasn't yet completely distraught, because there was just the chance I'd left it in the billiards room. Otherwise, my hope was that someone had borrowed it and would give it back in the morning. Well, the tape didn't turn up the next day, and I've still no idea what happened to it. The truth is, I suppose, there was far more thieving going on at Hailsham than we or the Guardians ever wanted to admit. But the reason I'm going into all this now is to explain about Ruth and how she reacted. What you have to remember is that I lost my tape less than a month after that time Midge had quizzed Ruth in the art room about her pencil case, and I'd come to the rescue. Ever since, as I told you, Ruth had been looking out for something nice to do for me in return, and the tape disappearing gave her a real opportunity. You could even say it wasn't until after my tape vanished that things got back to normal with us. Maybe for the first time since that rainy morning I'd mentioned the sales register to her under the eaves of the main house. The night I first noticed the tape had gone, I'd made sure to ask everyone about it, and that, of course, had included Ruth. Looking back, I can see how she must have realized, then and there, exactly what losing the tape meant to me, and at the same time how important it was for me there was no fuss. So she'd replied that night with a distracted shrug, and gone on with what she was doing. But the next morning, when I was coming back from the bathroom, I could hear her, in a casual voice like it wasn't anything much, asking Hannah if she was sure she hadn't seen my tape. Then, maybe a fortnight later, when I'd long reconciled myself to having truly lost my tape, she came and found me during the lunch break. It was one of the first really good days of spring that year, and I'd been sitting on the grass talking with a couple of the older girls. When Ruth came up and asked if I wanted to go for a little stroll, it was obvious she had something particular on her mind. So I left the older girls and followed her to the edge of the north playing field, then up the north hill, until we were standing there by the wooden fence, looking down on the sweep of green dotted with clusters of students. There was a strong breeze at the top of the hill, and I remember being surprised by it, because I hadn't noticed it down on the grass. We stood there looking over the grounds for a while. Then she held out a little bag to me. When I took it, I could tell there was a cassette tape inside, and my heart leapt. But Ruth said immediately, "Cathy, it's not your one, the one you lost. I tried to find it for you, but it's really gone." "Yeah," I said, "gone to Norfolk." We both laughed. Then I took the tape out of the bag with a disappointed air, and I'm not sure the disappointment wasn't still there on my face while I examined it. I was holding something called 20 Classic Dance Tunes. When I played it later, I discovered it was orchestra stuff for ballroom dancing. Of course, the moment she was giving it to me, I didn't know what sort of music it was, but I did know it wasn't anything like Judy Bridgewater. Then again, almost immediately, I saw how Ruth wasn't to know that. How to Ruth, who didn't know the first thing about music, this tape might easily make up for the one I'd lost. And suddenly I felt the disappointment ebbing away and being replaced by a real happiness. We didn't do things like hug each other much at Hailsham, but I squeezed one of her hands in both mine when I thanked her. She said, "I found it at the last sale. I just thought it's the sort of thing you'd like." And I said that yes, it was exactly the sort of thing. I still have it now. I don't play it much because the music has nothing to do with anything. It's an object, like a brooch or a ring. And especially now Ruth has gone, it's become one of my most precious possessions. Chapter 7. I want to move on now to our last years at Hailsham. I'm talking about the period from when we were 13 to when we left at 16. In my memory, my life at Hailsham falls into two distinct chunks. This last era, and everything that came before. The earlier years, the ones I've just been telling you about, they tend to blur into each other as a kind of golden time, and when I think about them at all, even the not-so-great things, I can't help feeling a sort of glow. But those last years feel different. They weren't unhappy, exactly. I've got plenty of memories I treasure from them. But they were more serious, and in some ways darker. Maybe I've exaggerated it in my mind, but I got an impression of things changing rapidly around then, like day moving into night. That talk with Tommy beside the pond, I think of it now as a kind of marker between the two eras. Not that anything significant started to happen immediately afterwards, but for me at least, that conversation was a turning point. I definitely started to look at everything differently. Where before I'd have backed away from awkward stuff, I began instead, more and more, to ask questions, if not out loud, at least within myself. In particular, that conversation got me looking at Miss Lucy in a new light. I watched her carefully whenever I could, not just from curiosity, but because I now saw her as the most likely source of important clues. And that's how it was. Over the next year or two, I came to notice various odd little things she said or did that my friends missed altogether. There was the time, for example, maybe a few weeks after the talk by the pond, when Miss Lucy was taking us for English. We'd been looking at some poetry, but had somehow drifted onto talking about soldiers in World War II being kept in prison camps. One of the boys asked if the fences around the camps had been electrified, and then someone else had said how strange it must have been, living in a place like that, where you could commit suicide any time you liked, just by touching a fence. This might have been intended as a serious point, but the rest of us thought it pretty funny. We were all laughing and talking at once, and then Laura, typical of her, got up on her seat and did a hysterical impersonation of someone reaching out and getting electrocuted. For a moment things got riotous, with everyone shouting and mimicking touching electric fences. I went on watching Miss Lucy through all this, and I could see, just for a second, a ghostly expression come over her face as she watched the class in front of her. Then, I kept watching carefully. She pulled herself together, smiled and said, "It's just as well the fences at Hailsham aren't electrified. You get terrible accidents sometimes." She said this quite softly, and because people were still shouting she was more or less drowned out. But I heard her clearly enough. "You get terrible accidents sometimes." What accidents? Where? But no one picked her up on it, and we went back to discussing our poem. There were other little incidents like that, and before long I came to see Miss Lucy as being not quite like the other guardians. It's even possible I began to realize, right back then, the nature of her worries and frustrations, but that's probably going too far. Chances are, at the time, I noticed all these things without knowing what on earth to make of them. And if these incidents now seem full of significance and all of a piece, it's probably because I'm looking at them in the light of what came later. Particularly what happened that day at the pavilion, while we were sheltering from the downpour. We were 15 by then, already into our last year at Hailsham. We'd been in the pavilion getting ready for a game of rounders. The boys were going through a phase of enjoying rounders in order to flirt with us, so there were over 30 of us that afternoon. The downpour had started while we were changing, and we found ourselves gathering on the veranda, which was sheltered by the pavilion roof, while we waited for it to stop. But the rain kept going, and when the last of us had emerged, the veranda was pretty crowded, with everyone milling around restlessly. I remember Laura was demonstrating to me an especially disgusting way of blowing your nose for when you really wanted to put off a boy. Miss Lucy was the only guardian present. She was leaning over the rail at the front, peering into the rain like she was trying to see right across the playing field. I was watching her as carefully as ever in those days, and even as I was laughing at Laura, I was stealing glances at Miss Lucy's back. I remember wondering if there wasn't something a bit odd about her posture, the way her head was bent down just a little too far, so she looked like a crouching animal waiting to pounce, and the way she was leaning forward over the rail meant drops from the overhanging gutter were only just missing her. But she seemed to show no sign of caring. I remember actually convincing myself there was nothing unusual in all this, that she was simply anxious for the rain to stop, and turning my attention back to what Laura was saying. Then a few minutes later, when I'd forgotten all about Miss Lucy and was laughing my head off at something, I suddenly realized things had gone quiet around us and that Miss Lucy was speaking. She was standing at the same spot as before, but she'd turned to face us now, so her back was against the rail and the rainy sky behind her. No, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to interrupt you, she was saying, and I could see she was talking to two boys sitting on the benches immediately in front of her. Her voice wasn't exactly strange, but she was speaking very loudly, in the sort of voice she'd used to announce something to the lot of us, and that was why we'd all gone quiet. No, Peter, I'm going to have to stop you. I can't listen to you any more and keep silent. Then she raised her gaze to include the rest of us and took a deep breath. All right, you can hear this. It's for all of you. It's time someone spelt it out. We waited while she kept staring at us. Later, some people said they'd thought she was going to give us a big telling off, others that she was about to announce a new rule on how we played rounders, but I knew before she said another word it would be something more. Boys, you must forgive me for listening, but you were right behind me so I couldn't help it. Peter, why don't you tell the others what you were saying to Gordon just now? Peter Jay looked bewildered, and I could see him getting ready his injured innocence face. But then Miss Lucy said again, this time much more gently, Peter, go on. Please tell the others what you were just saying. Peter shrugged. We were just talking about what it would feel like if we became actors. What sort of life it would be. Yes, Miss Lucy said. And you were saying to Gordon you'd have to go to America to stand the best chance. Peter Jay shrugged again and muttered quietly, Yes, Miss Lucy. But Miss Lucy was now moving her gaze over the lot of us. I know you don't mean any harm, but there's just too much talk like this. I hear it all the time. It's been allowed to go on, and it's not right. I could see more drops coming off the gutter and landing on her shoulder, but she didn't seem to notice. If no one else will talk to you, she continued, then I will. The problem, as I see it, is that you've been told and not told. You've been told, but none of you really understand, and I dare say some people are quite happy to leave it that way. But I'm not. If you're going to have decent lives, then you've got to know, and know properly. None of you will go to America. None of you will be film stars. And none of you will be working in supermarkets, as I heard some of you planning the other day. Your lives are set out for you. You'll become adults. Then, before you're old, before you're even middle-aged, you'll start to donate your vital organs. That's what each of you was created to do. You're not like the actors you watch on your videos. You're not even like me. You were brought into this world for a purpose, and your futures, all of them, have been decided. So you're not to talk that way anymore. You'll be leaving Hailsham before long, and it's not so far off the day you'll be preparing for your first donations. You need to remember that. If you're to have decent lives, you have to know who you are and what lies ahead of you. Every one of you. Then she went silent. But my impression was that she was continuing to say things inside her head, because for some time her gaze kept roving over us, going from face to face, just as if she were still speaking to us. We were all pretty relieved when she turned to look out over the playing field again. "It's not so bad now," she said, even though the rain was as steady as ever. "Let's just go out there. Then maybe the sun will come out too." I think that was all she said. When I was discussing it with Ruth a few years ago at the centre in Dover, she claimed Miss Lucy had told us a lot more, that she'd explained how before donations we'd all spend some time first as carers, about the usual sequence of the donations, the recovery centres, and so on. But I'm pretty sure she didn't. Okay, she probably intended to when she began talking, but my guess is once she'd set off, once she'd seen the puzzled, uncomfortable faces in front of her, she realized the impossibility of completing what she'd started. It's hard to say clearly what sort of impact Miss Lucy's outburst at the pavilion made. Word got around fast enough, but the talk mostly focused on Miss Lucy herself rather than on what she'd been trying to tell us. Some students thought she'd lost her marbles for a moment, others that she'd been asked to say what she had by Miss Emily and the other guardians. There were even some who'd actually been there and who thought Miss Lucy had been telling us off for being too rowdy on the veranda. But as I say, there was surprisingly little discussion about what she'd said. If it did come up, people tended to say, "Well, so what? We already knew all that." But that had been Miss Lucy's point exactly. We'd been told and not told, as she'd put it. A few years ago, when Tommy and I were going over it all again, and I reminded him of Miss Lucy's told-and-not-told idea, he came up with a theory. Tommy thought it possible the guardians had, throughout all our years at Hailsham, timed very carefully and deliberately everything they told us, so that we were always just too young to understand properly the latest piece of information. But of course we take it in at some level, so that before long all this stuff was there in our heads, without us ever having examined it properly. It's a bit too much like a conspiracy theory for me. I don't think our guardians were that crafty, but there's probably something in it. Certainly it feels like I always knew about donations in some vague way, even as early as 6 or 7. And it's curious, when we were older and the guardians were giving us those talks, nothing came as a complete surprise. It was like we'd heard everything somewhere before. One thing that occurs to me now is that when the guardians first started giving us proper lectures about sex, they tended to run them together with talk about the donations. At that age, again I'm talking of around 13, we were all pretty worried and excited about sex, and naturally would have pushed the other stuff into the background. In other words, it's possible the guardians managed to smuggle into our heads a lot of the basic facts about our futures. Now, to be fair, it was probably natural to run these two subjects together. If, say, they were telling us how we'd have to be very careful to avoid diseases when we had sex, it would have been odd not to mention how much more important this was for us than for normal people outside. And that, of course, would bring us on to the donations. Then there was the whole business about our not being able to have babies. Miss Emily used to give a lot of the sex lectures herself, and I remember once she brought in a life-size skeleton from the biology class to demonstrate how it was done. We watched in complete astonishment as she put the skeleton through various contortions, thrusting her pointer around without the slightest self-consciousness. She was going through all the nuts and bolts of how you did it, what went in where, the different variations, like this was still geography. Then suddenly, with the skeleton in an obscene heap on the desktop, she turned away, and began telling us how we had to be careful who we had sex with. Not just because of the diseases, but because, she said, sex affects emotions in ways you'd never expect. We had to be extremely careful about having sex in the outside world, especially with people who weren't students, because out there sex meant all sorts of things. Out there people were even fighting and killing each other over who had sex with whom. And the reason it meant so much more than, say, dancing or table tennis, was because the people out there were different from us students. They could have babies from sex. That was why it was so important to them, this question of who did it with whom. And even though, as we knew, it was completely impossible for any of us to have babies, out there we had to behave like them. We had to respect the rules and treat sex as something pretty special. Miss Emily's lecture that day was typical of what I'm talking about. We'd be focusing on sex, and then the other stuff would creep in. I suppose that was all part of how we came to be told and not told. I think in the end, we must have absorbed quite a lot of information, because I remember around that age a marked change in the way we approached the whole territory surrounding the donations. Until then, as I've said, we'd done everything to avoid the subject. We'd backed off at the first sign we were entering that ground, and there'd been severe punishment for any idiot, like Marge that time, who got careless. But from when we were 13, like I say, things started to change. We still didn't discuss the donations and all that went with them. We still found the whole area awkward enough. But it became something we made jokes about, in much the way we joked about sex. Looking back now, I'd say the rule about not discussing the donations openly was still there, as strong as ever. But now it was okay, almost required, every now and then, to make some jokey allusion to these things that lay in front of us. A good example is what happened the time Tommy got the gash on his elbow. It must have been just before my talk with him by the pond. A time, I suppose, when Tommy was still coming out of that phase of being teased and taunted. It wasn't such a bad gash, and though he was sent to Crowface to have it seen to, he was back almost straight away with a square of dressing plastered to his elbow. No one thought much about it until a couple of days later, when Tommy took off the dressing to reveal something at just that stage between sealing and still being an open wound. You could see bits of skin starting to bond, and soft red bits peeping up from underneath. We were in the middle of lunch, so everyone crowded round to go, "Ugh." Then Christopher H., from the year above, said with a dead straight face, "Pity it's on that bit of the elbow. Just about anywhere else it wouldn't matter." Tommy looked worried, Christopher being someone he looked up to in those days, and asked what he meant. Christopher went on eating, then said nonchalantly, "Don't you know? If it's right on the elbow like that, it can unzip. All you have to do is bend your arm quickly. Not just that actual bit, the whole elbow. It can all unzip like a bag opening up. Thought you'd know that." I could hear Tommy complaining that Crowface hadn't warned him of anything of that sort, but Christopher shrugged and said, "She thought you knew, of course. Everyone knows." A number of people nearby murmured agreement. "You've got to keep your arm dead straight," someone else said. "Bending it at all's really dangerous." The next day I could see Tommy going about with his arm held out very rigidly and looking worried. Everybody was laughing at him, and I was cross about that, but I had to admit there was a funny side to it. Then towards the end of the afternoon, as we were leaving the art room, he came up to me in the corridor and said, "Kath, can I just have a quick word?" This was maybe a couple of weeks after the time I'd gone up to him in the playing field to remind him about his polo shirt, so it had got about we were special friends of some sort. All the same, his coming up like that asking for a private talk was pretty embarrassing and threw me off balance. Maybe that partly explains why I wasn't more helpful than I was. "I'm not too worried or anything," he began, once he'd got me aside. "But I wanted to play safe, that's all. We should never take chances with our health. I need someone to help, Kath." He was, he explained, concerned about what he'd do in his sleep. He might easily bend his elbow in the night. "I have these dreams all the time where I'm fighting loads of Roman soldiers." When I quizzed him a bit, it became obvious all kinds of people People who hadn't been there that lunchtime had been coming up to him to repeat Christopher H.'s warning. In fact, it seemed a few had carried the joke further. Tommy had been told of a student who'd gone to sleep with a cut on the elbow, just like his, and woken up to find his whole upper arm and hand skeletally exposed, the skin flopping about next to him, like one of those long gloves in My Fair Lady. What Tommy was asking me now was to help tie a splint on the arm to keep it rigid through the night. "I don't trust any of the others," he said, holding up a thick ruler he wanted to use. "They might deliberately do it so it comes undone in the night." He was looking at me in complete innocence, and I didn't know what to say. A part of me wanted badly to tell him what was going on, and I suppose I knew that to do anything else would be to betray the trust we'd built up since the moment I'd reminded him about his polo shirt. And for me to strap up his arm in a splint would have meant my becoming one of the main perpetrators of the joke. I still feel ashamed I didn't tell him then. But you've got to remember I was still young, and that I only had a few seconds to decide. And when someone's asking you to do something in such a pleading way, everything goes against saying no. I suppose the main thing was that I didn't want to upset him, because I could see, for all his anxiety about his elbow, Tommy was touched by all the concern he believed had been shown him. Of course I knew he'd find out the truth sooner or later, but at that moment I just couldn't tell him. The best I could do was to ask, "Did Crowface tell you you had to do this?" "No, but imagine how angry she'd be if my elbow slipped out." I still feel bad about it, but I promised to strap his arm for him, in room 14, half an hour before the night bell, and watched him go off grateful and reassured. As it happened, I didn't have to go through with it because Tommy found out first. It was around 8 in the evening. I was coming down the main staircase and heard a burst of laughter rising up the stairwell from the ground floor. My heart sank, because I knew immediately it was to do with Tommy. I paused on the first floor landing and looked over the rail just as Tommy came out of the billiards room with thunderous footsteps. I remember thinking, at least he's not shouting. And he didn't. The whole time he went to the cloakroom, got his things, and left the main house. And all that time, laughter kept coming from the open doorway of the billiards room, and voices yelling things like, "If you lose your temper, your elbow will definitely pop out." I thought about following him out into the evening and catching up with him before he got to his dorm hut, but then I remembered how I'd promised to put his arm in a splint for the night and didn't move. I just kept saying to myself, at least he didn't have a tantrum. At least he kept hold of that temper. But I've gone off a bit. The reason I was talking about all this was because the idea of things unzipping carried over from Tommy's elbow to become a running joke among us about the donations. The idea was that when the time came, you'd be able just to unzip a bit of yourself. A kidney or something would slide out and you'd hand it over. It wasn't something we found so funny in itself. It was more a way of putting each other off our food. You unzipped your liver, say, and dumped it on someone's plate, that sort of thing. I remember once Gary B., who had this unbelievable appetite, coming back with a third helping of pudding and virtually the whole table unzipping bits of themselves and piling it all over Gary's bowl while he went on determinedly stuffing himself. Tommy never liked it much when the unzipping stuff came up again, but by then the days of his being teased were past and no one connected the joke with him any more. It was just done to get a laugh, to put someone off their dinner, and, I suppose, as some way of acknowledging what was in front of us. And this was my original point. By that time in our lives, we no longer shrank from the subject of donations, as we'd have done a year or two earlier. But neither did we think about it very seriously or discuss it. All that business about unzipping, that was typical of the way the whole subject impinged on us when we were 13. So I'd say Miss Lucy had it about right when she said, a couple of years later, that we'd been told and not told. And what's more, now I think about it, I'd say what Miss Lucy said to us that afternoon led to a real shift in our attitudes. It was after that day jokes about donations faded away, and we started to think properly about things. If anything, the donations went back to being subject to be avoided, but not in the way it had been when we were younger. This time round, it wasn't awkward or embarrassing any more, just somber and serious. "It's funny," Tommy said to me when we were remembering it all again a few years ago. None of us stopped to think about how she felt. Miss Lucy herself. We never worried if she'd got into trouble saying what she did to us. We were so selfish back then.
"But you can't blame us," I said. We'd been taught to think about each other, but never about the guardians. The idea the guardians had differences between them, that never occurred to us.
"But we were old enough," Tommy said. "By that age it should have occurred to us. But it didn't. We didn't think about poor Miss Lucy at all. Not even after that time, you know, when you saw her."
I knew straight away what he meant. He was talking about the morning early in our last summer at Hailsham, when I'd stumbled across her up in room 22. Thinking about it now, I'd say Tommy had a point. After that moment it should have been clear, even to us, how troubled Miss Lucy had become. But as he said, we never considered anything from her viewpoint, and it never occurred to us to say or do anything to support her.
Chapter 8. Many of us had turned 16 by then. It was a morning of brilliant sunshine, and we'd all just come down to the courtyard after a lesson in the main house, when I remembered something I'd left in the classroom. So I went back up to the third floor, and that's how the thing with Miss Lucy happened. In those days I had this secret game. When I found myself alone, I'd stop and look for a view, out of a window, say, or through a doorway into a room, any view so long as there were no people in it. I did this so that I could, for a few seconds at least, create the illusion the place wasn't crawling with students, but that instead Hailsham was this quiet, tranquil house where I lived with just 5 or 6 others. To make this work, you had to get yourself into a sort of dream and shut off all the stray noises and voices. Usually you had to be pretty patient, too. If, say, you were focusing from a window on one particular bit of the playing field, you could wait ages for those couple of seconds when there wasn't anyone at all in your frame. Anyway, that was what I was doing that morning after I'd fetched whatever it was I'd left in the classroom and come back out onto the third floor landing. I was keeping very still near a window, looking down onto a section of the courtyard where I'd been standing only moments before. My friends had gone, and the courtyard was steadily emptying, so I was waiting for my trick to work, when I heard behind me what sounded like gas or steam escaping in sharp bursts. It was a hissing noise that would go on for about 10 seconds, pause, then come again. I wasn't alarmed exactly, but since I seemed to be the only person around, I thought I'd better go and investigate. I went across the landing towards the sound, along the corridor past the room I'd just been in, and down to room 22, second from the end. The door was partly open, and just as I came up to it, the hissing started up again with a new intensity. I don't know what I expected to discover as I cautiously pushed the door, but I was properly surprised to find Miss Lucy. Room 22 was hardly used for classes because it was so small, and even on a day like that one, hardly any light got in. The guardians sometimes went in there to mark our work or get on with reading. That morning the room was darker than ever because the blinds had been pulled almost all the way down. There were 2 tables pushed together for a group to sit around, but Miss Lucy was there alone near the back. I could see several loose sheets of dark, shiny paper scattered over the table in front of her. She herself was leaning over in concentration, forehead very low, arms up on the surface, scrawling furious lines over a page with a pencil. Underneath the heavy black lines, I could see neat blue handwriting. As I watched, she went on scrubbing the pencil point over the paper, almost in the way we did shading in art, except her movements were much more angry, as if she didn't mind gouging right through the sheet. Then I realized, in the same instant, that this was the source of the odd noise, and that what I'd taken for dark, shiny paper on the table had also, not long before, been pages of neat handwriting. She was so lost in what she was doing, it took a while for her to realize I was there. When she looked up with a start, I could see her face was flushed, but there were no traces of tears. She stared.